Okay, so we now have a bunch of poster talks. So these will be 5 minutes plus 2 minutes of questions, and I'll give you 1 minute.
Okay.
Right, so we start off with Nora Shipp from the University of Chicago.
Right. Yeah, so I'm Nora Shipp. I'm a grad student at the University of Chicago. My poster is on velocity measurements of the DES Dark Energy Survey stellar streams. So last year we discovered 11 new stellar streams in the Dark Energy Survey and also have improved observations of 4 previously known streams. So to find these streams, we did an unweighted match filter search in color magnitude space where we selected stars around old and metal poor isochrones. And then this figure here shows stellar density maps that we made at different distance moduli of stars within this selection. So the movie is moving out to larger distances in the stellar halo. So in this figure, darker is higher density. So all of these dark linear features you see here are the stellar streams that we discovered, and they're labeled on this panel. Okay, so since then we've been working on getting kinematic measurements of all of these streams. Ting is going to talk later about a spectroscopic survey that she's been leading. I've also been working on getting proper motion measurements since Gaia DR2. So I'm using a data set that's cross-matched between Gaia DR2 and DES DR1. So I've been using the DES photometry to select stars that are likely members of the DES streams, and then looking for the proper motion signal in the Gaia data. So this figure here shows some of the selections that we make for one of the clearest streams. So we make a color magnitude cut around the isochrones that I fit to the DES data. For some streams, we also use a color cut to select metal poor stars, and then select stars that lie along the stream spatially. So you can see in this panel, this is stars that lie along the stream and are metal poor. You can see the signal that belongs to the Atlas stream. And the signal doesn't show up if you look at either metal-rich stars or metal poor stars lying off of the stream. So this process is more difficult for stellar streams than for dwarf galaxies because the stars are spread over a larger area of the sky, so we have greater foreground contamination. But we've still been able to get confident proper motion measurements for 9 of the DES streams. And that's including our most distant stream, Elke, which is at a distance of 50 kiloparsecs. And we weren't really sure whether that would be possible because of the much brighter magnitude limit of Gaia than DES. So after finding these proper motion signals, used a Gaussian mixture model, fit a 2-component Gaussian mixture model to get uncertainties on the proper motion measurements and to fit gradients of the 2 proper motion components along the stream. So here the colors show the membership probability based on the proper motion and the spatial position. So yellow is the highest membership probability. So you can see that the stars lie nicely along the best fit isochrones, and these 2 panels show the gradient of the proper motions. For this stream and most of the other DES streams, we don't see significant gradients. For one of the larger ones, we do see a gradient. Okay, so one interesting result that we're seeing in these proper motion values is that a lot of the streams seem to have proper motions that are offset from the direction of the stream track. So for a stream on a simple orbit, you expect the proper motion to be along the direction of the track. In this figure, the black lines, like this one, show the track of the stream, and the blue arrows show the direction of the proper motion. So for almost all of them, we see a clear offset. And this, the orange star is the present-day position, the LMC, and the orange line shows the 1 giga-year orbit of the LMC. So you can see that most of the streams are actually, their offsets are pointing towards the LMC. So we think that this is a sign that the LMC has perturbed these streams in the southern hemisphere. And one other interesting thing that we've been thinking about is the fact that it looks like the dwarf galaxy streams seem to have larger offsets than the globular cluster streams. And it's hard to tell whether that's a real thing because there's so few of these streams right now. But for example, the ones over here are mostly dwarf galaxies. These are some globular clusters that have much smaller offsets. So if anyone has ideas about what could cause that, let me know. So the next thing that I'm working on is modeling, working with Dennis Urkel on modeling one of these streams to try to explain the offset and the proper motion and other observed properties of the stream and to constrain the mass of the LMC.
Okay, we can have a couple of quick questions. James?
So you found these from the photometry alone, correct?
Yes.
Have you tried searching using the proper motions?
I have not done an additional search yet.
Is anybody else working on that? Okay. Any more questions?
So, yeah, it seems like that they're also like this offsets, students that are displayed offsets are all at like RA greater than zero or so.
Yeah.
Like, any comments on that?
Well, the dwarf galaxy streams for some reason are clustered over there, and I don't know why that would be, but it's the same as the division between dwarf galaxies and globular clusters.
So I'm wondering if you, I mean, I saw this result last week. Have you had a chance to look at the wakes in the numerical simulations from the LMC?
Because I have not, but I do think that would be interesting.
Yeah, because I think the spatial difference is interesting. You're talking about dwarfs versus globulars, but I'm seeing
maybe
it
the
as a
spatial
difference.
Also.
Not
okay.
Final counting.
I want to make a comment that we actually don't know if the streams are actually global cluster or not. I would say those are thin streams and a thick stream right now from the west, right? And so the one that on the right-hand side, they are all pretty wide in the west, and they are probably pretty massive dwarf galaxies. But those thin ones can be either global clusters or ultra faint. That's what I would say. And we don't know that yet.
Okay, on that note, let's thank Nora again. And we can move on to Sergio Yu from UC Irvine.
Hello? Okay. So hi everyone, my name is CJ Yu and I go by Anna, so if you can't pronounce my name, just call me Anna. So I'm a grad student at UC Irvine working with James Bullock. So the poster that I'm presenting today is basically about our work on using the fire simulation to study the stellar halo of Milky Way-like galaxies. So this is one of the visualization of the one of the simulations that we are using. So talking about stellar halos, there are different formation mechanisms. So in Katherine Johnson's earlier paper, she has sorted stars in a stellar halo into three different families according to their dynamic origins. So we actually focus on the in-situ stars, which are the stars that form in orbits close to the current orbits. So for the in-situ star, the classic model about how they form is the ELS model, in which they believe those stars were born on eccentric orbits from radially infalling gas cloud. So now look at the simulations. I think many of you have already noticed that we are in those visualizations, we are actually seeing those stars getting kicked out from the center. So it is very interesting, right? Because we know the gas cloud, it can be pushed out by some forces, but the stars, why are they getting pushed out? Right? So that's what James has, like, he told me he looked at this visualization a thousand times, and he still can't figure out what's happening in this kind of weird stuff. And also, if we plot the burst radius versus the present radius, so the burst radius is the distance of the stars when they born to the center of the galaxy at that moment. So here in this plot, we can actually see three different families. The first one, the heated disk, which is the stars that fall basically in this one-to-one line here. They are actually where they were born, basically. Or some of them are heated, so they're perturbed to smaller or larger radius. And also those accreted stuff, they have really, really large burst radius. They're born really far away from the center of the galaxy, but are now pretty close to the center of the galaxy today. And then it's the weird thing that we see in our simulations that those stars are born with really small burst radius. They were born really close to the center of the galaxy, but are now going out to, say, 300 kiloparsec from the center of the galaxies, forming this kind of like horizontal bands extended to the right. But we still don't know what's happening here. We just see it in our simulation. So in order to understand what's going on here, we actually need to look at, for example, the gas behavior right before they turn into stars. However, unfortunately, the time interval between different snapshots, like in the original run, is not very high and it's not short enough for us to really see what's happening there. So what we did is we actually select one sample event and we run the simulation before that event happens, and luckily we see some similar events happening at about the same time, and that's basically it. At about the same time and at about the same place, which means it's not some random things in our simulation. There are something happening right there. So in this movie, we're showing we are actually grabbing some of the particles in the stream and trace them back to find our parent gas particle. So in the movie, the magenta points are the parent gas particle, and those colorful ones are the star particles color-coded by the star formation time. And here in the left plot, we show the average velocity of those particles as a function of time. So what we are seeing here is the gas cloud, they got compressed and then accelerated right before they turn into stars. So the stars formed inside that gas cloud would have really high initial velocity. And because it's still interacting with the galaxy potential, so it will rapidly decelerate it. And also because there are bounds, so after some time, they will fall back in and contribute to the stellar halo today. So this is basically our picture of how those interesting events happen in our simulation. We've also looked at some of their properties, but I guess I don't have time to talk about it. So if you are interested, just go to the poster. And here is the summary. Basically, we are discovering star formation inside galactic outflows. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you very much. We have time for a couple of quick questions. Yeah, Monica.
So you did have, in your plot with the birth radius versus current radius, you did have the age of those stars. And I noticed that most of them are fairly old, right? So they're like the blue thing. So have you looked into whether the disk had actually formed at that time? Because we've done, Sarah Loebman and I have been looking at the same thing, and we find these sort of in-situ population stars, at least things which are classified as in situ in the halo, but the majority of them actually form before you can actually see a realistic disk. And so we call them sort of the proto-halo, you know, because it wasn't really a disk. And so it's sort of, you know, the stuff that came in and formed the bulge and so, you know, extent splashed out into the halo. So that's what we think they are.
So we don't really look at, like, whether they have disk or not. Because what we are seeing is they're forming this kind of like weird, like stream going out. So it's
But they're actually young. Of course, they were blue, which was age of 40 years.
Okay, blue. I thought they were old.
So they're not that young compared to the disk, because disk is, as you can see in the 1-to-1 ratio line, those are kind of like bluish. They form like 1 giga years. And those red, like yellower, greener ones, they're like 6 giga years, some of them. And also, that is a scatter plot. So if you really want to look at the star formation time, we have to look at the histogram of that. I don't really have it here. Yeah.
Okay, very, very, very quick question from Jürgen.
Right. Yeah, I was just wondering, like, have you thought of like how we could potentially test this? I mean, in the Milky Way, or even potentially like in Andromeda, like there's a PFS survey that's going to come online soon.
So basically, we're seeing that they have very different properties than those accreted stuff. As in chemical abundances, there are more metal rich and there are more alpha enhanced.
Yeah. So that should be potentially testable.
Yeah, right? That should be. And also, we are looking at also the kinematic structures as well, like that.
Okay, let's thank Sujit again. Okay. Next up, we have Ned Hajazi from Georgia State University.
So hello, everyone. Thank you for giving me some opportunity to talk about my work. So first, why M dwarfs? They are the most abundant stars in the galaxy and belonging to the older, the oldest stellar populations. But there are always two main problems with these stars. The molecular bands we have in spectra make the spectroscopy very complicated. And first, and the second is that these stars are rather faint, and especially in very M subdwarf, the very metal poor M subdwarf, are really faint. And achieving a high resolution, high signal to noise spectra is very difficult, sometimes is not possible. But on the other hand, low medium resolution are available in large number in different sample, different surveys. As well as our samples that include 1700 M subdwarf and M dwarf and M subdwarf and across my 1500 with Gaia data. And these are the sample or high proper motion sample, and these are so low medium resolution spectroscopy spectra. And it is a cut that we showed it. You can see in the diagram, and that shows the limit of the proper motion. And you know that every any high proper motion sample overselects the very nearby stars or very high velocity stars. So we determined the classified our stars based on and template fitting method that they are actually according to a measurement of TIO and CH molecular band indices. And so we actually, we assigned the spectrotype and metallicity class to these sample. And the second part that is the most painstaking, most difficult part of our work is the determination of physical parameters like temperature, metallicity, alpha elements, and surface gravity. Our results show that our metallicity shows that are really good because they can we can separate in the HR diagram. We can separate different range of metallicity or different metallicity class in HR diagram. They are very greatly separated, so we can separate different population in this such a diagram. And if we, in this cases that the parallaxes are not available, a reduced proper motion diagram can even can be used to separate the, again different stellar populations. And so this all shows that our actual metallicity rather is safe while we have used low or medium resolution spectras. So here is that. It is for first time that I'm showing the alpha elements versus metallicity in M dwarfs, and so we can see that that is even the our diagram has reached to very very low metallicity stars. To compare, I have shown two other studies for FGK dwarfs, or more massive stars. The lines that can you can see that these are separate, that that have been suggested for separate thick disk and thin disk for in from different studies. But is that very applicable for our stars? Because M dwarfs in the left panel are in on average have have higher values of alpha elements for given a metallicity. So it makes sense because the M stars or M dwarfs are significantly older than FGK stars. And so we can also see some different substructure in this diagram. So we have we can see some stars that have unusually higher value of alpha or a very lower value of alpha elements that is in the circle, in the green circle. And there are some substructure, there are some voids, there are some low density of a starting diagram. And so, we, for example, one of them in the, that I have shown by a green arrow, this low density star maybe this is the same as this have been shown, that have been observed in the FGK stars. So it seems that there is something going on in around this region. It may be the ending point of the disk or a starting point of the halo stars. other substructure, maybe for the halos, for the very metaphor regions, may indicate that they might associated with different subcomponents in the halo. So we need to work on hard on it. So if we want to understand very carefully about this substructure, we need more stars. We need larger samples. So we are going to apply a pipeline for parameter to larger sample of STSS, as well we are going to measure the high resolution spectra by APO for very unusually higher or lower value of alpha elements to understand better this structure. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. A quick question or two. Chow at the back.
So it seems like that your M-dwarf sample has more metal poor stars, at least lower than -2.
Yes.
Is that the selection effect or is...
Yes.
Is this a selection effect?
Because they are lower than -2.
Yeah, you select this from the velocity, or select this from.
Yes. Because you're right. Or sample over selects the very high velocity started from halos. Yes. Okay. That's important. Yes.
So, did you look at the chemical substructures in proper motion and in velocity? For the chemical substructures you were pointing out?
We are going to do this. Okay. It's important. Yes. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Let's thank Ned again. And we can move on to Eric Mendelson from RPI.
Testing? Okay. Hello, my name's Eric Mendelson. I'm from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and I'm a graduate student working under Professor Newberg. So my talk is going to be about how we're using Milky Way at home in order to fit the progenitor dwarf galaxy for a stream like the Orphan Stream. And before I begin, I probably should explain what Milky Way at Home actually is. So Milky Way at Home is a collection of volunteer computers all around the world that work together in order to kind of brute force what the parameters for a progenitor dwarf galaxy is. So what we do is we take some sort of data, so data like this that shows a stellar distribution across the stream, and we put it into the Milky Way at Home server, and the server generates a bunch of work units over a certain parameter range. So we use 5 parameters to determine that define what the M-body simulation is going to do. So we have an evolution time, and this is typically between 2 and 6 years. We have a baryon mass, which is for the case of our tested simulation was between 1 and 99 structure units, where a structure unit is around 222,288.47 solar masses. Yes, I remember the number. So we run over these baryon masses. We have a baryon radius as well, because this is because we represent these dwarf galaxies as 2 Plummer spheres. So we have a baryon scalar radius, and we also have a dark matter scalar radius. And the dark matter component and radius component are inputted in as these ratios, where these are, this would be 1% baryons, then 99% dark matter. So that explains what these parameters are. But it creates a bunch of work units over this 5-dimensional phase space, and then it sends out all these work units to computers all around the world. And for each one of these computers, it runs the M-body simulation for the given amount of time, and it produces a very similar plot like this. And then it compares the input histogram with its result, and it makes a calculation called a likelihood calculation that determines how close is the generated histogram to our current histogram. And it takes 3 things into account. It takes into account the shape, or how much do I have to deform this one stream in order to get it to match our other stream. It also takes into account the masses between the two, and the beta and the velocity dispersion, which gives us our total width. And this is the general equation for this. And after it produces likelihood, it sends it back to the Milky Way home server, and it uses a differential evolution genetic algorithm in order to attempt to produce better likelihood fits, and then after a while of like several weeks or months, it'll finally spit out the parameters for what the progenitor for this galaxy is. And in order to test that, my predecessor put in, he ran three runs for the same simulated data where like he generated a histogram with using these parameters up here. And then he did three separate trial runs, and these are the parameters that Milky Way at Home gave. So, and as you can see, we actually get really, really decent accuracy for the time, the baryon component, and the baryon radius. And we have some pretty good, and we still have some pretty good accuracies for the dark matter components as well. So this, So this shows that we are very much capable of fitting the dwarf parameter just by looking at the tidal stream alone. The only other things that we really need to consider are, in this case, when we change the seed for this sort of histogram up here, sometimes we can get really good fits, but other times the fits may be less than desirable. And we believe that the reason for this is because our current simulations only use around 20,000 bodies. And as you can see here, even when we use the same parameters across different seeds, we can actually get very, very different distributions. So this actually shows that we may need to use more bodies. And as such, like using like 50,000 bodies or 100,000 bodies, we actually see there's a lot less variance in this distribution. And we can even see here that we only use 20,000 bodies. This is over 100 different seeds. And this is the likelihood scores. We actually get, this is likelihood scores and this is counts. We get a much wider range of likelihoods using the same parameters. But if we use 100,000 bodies, it's actually a lot narrower. So in the future, we're hoping to, one, run this with real data, and two, run this using more bodies, possibly around 35,000.
Time for a question or two. So how many machines have you got, and how much fraction of time are those machines available to you?
Let's see. We have around, like, we have 20, I think we have, I think the number is like 25,000 users with about one petaflops of computing power. I'm not entirely sure how long they're available, but from what I've gathered, it normally takes about, 3 weeks to possibly 2 months to get an optimization back.
I'm just wondering, if you have loads of users, but you only can use them for like one day every 6 months, is that how it works, or it's mostly much higher fraction of time? We have Jake over here.
I'll mention that in my talk later.
Oh. So. Oh, okay.
Thank you very much, because I don't know the answer to that one.
Okay, Monica, quick
apologies.
Question.
So for your test, for the test run that you did and for the trials, did you use the same kinds of potential for your progenitor?
You mean like the Milky Way potential or the same?
For your progenitor, you said it. Did you use the same potential for the mock as well as for the trials? I mean, because
For the progenitors that we generated, both used for every single one of these runs, it uses a two-component Plummer scale model where we have a baryon Plummer sphere embedded in a dark matter Plummer sphere.
Okay. Yeah, I was just worried that if you don't know the potential and you change that, how well do you manage to recover your?
I mean, I'm trying to think. The progenitor that is generated, one, it does take into account a radial distribution, but I do know that it uses I'm trying to remember what it was. It does use a distribution function from, I think, Binney and Tremaine in order to calculate the velocity dispersions everywhere. So I think the potential can be accurately modeled in that case, yes.
OK, let's thank Eric again.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Good job.
And move on to Joss.
Just a short statement in preparation for the Blackboard session next week. I put up a little technology summary of the big developments that are happening around the world. You're all familiar with optics, light through lenses and mirrors and through gratings and so forth. Photonics is revolutionizing many aspects of the world, like sensors. It's a trillion-dollar industry. And it's no different for astronomy. And this is a sort of a color supplement that's coming out. There'll also be a much more technical version of this in Nature this year, a review. And photonics is light through materials, basically molding the flow of light. And you, of course, you'll know about lasers, lasers within fibers these days, quite amazing, within circuits. And when Australia joined ESO, it was my task. I headed an instrumentation group for 14 years, and I run a lab at Sydney University. And I was tasked with the thought of what would Australia contribute to the ESO, collaboration. And so one of the things we became aware of is that ESO has been pushing hard on the idea of codecs, that is to get 1 centimeter per second velocity resolution, velocity precision over, say, a 10-year time baseline to measure, to physically measure the expansion of the universe, to see the Doppler or the redshift change by a tiny amount, to look at the flow of galaxies. And immediately, I think several of us in my group realized, you know, this would be far more powerful in the shorter term for stars, looking at accelerations in stars. A number of people around the world have been thinking about this, but the step I've made, which I think has scared some people, but I think we have a history of showing we can achieve things in terms of new instruments, new technologies over 30 years, I would say that this is possible, that we can get radio velocity precisions to 10 centimeters per second. That's 10 times worse than codecs, but with a multi-object spectrograph, and then measure this for a million stars over something in several phases, 1 year, 3 years, and 10 years. And so the kinds of technology that we're using now, this is the Hermes spectrograph. It's 6 meters by 4 meters. It's a very large instrument, $15 million worth to build. It's not as impressive, of course, as the ESO 65 million euro instruments. We don't have those sorts of budgets, but it does good stuff. And this is a first demonstration we had of installing our photonic comb light through into these fibers. There's many fibers being lit up. That's basically 400 fibers being lit up in an annulus because of the way it's being fed. There are all sorts of clever tricks, photonic tricks, where you basically have split fibers that convert light into a donut to get past central obstructions. And we've shown already in the lab, at least, that we can stabilize spectroscopy to 10 centimeters per second quite easily, even down to 1 in the lab. On a telescope, I don't think we'll achieve 1 without ESO-level budgets. So maybe codecs will achieve that. So my last slide is the following. A history of radial velocities. Relatively easy to get to 1 kilometer per second. You can build those in a matter of hours now with small instruments and put them on little telescopes and get to that sort of precision. Rave and Gaia achieved that, and that's like 1 in 3 times 105. Apogee and Galar have gone a factor of 10 better for the same sort of magnitude range when you match like with like. Exoplanetary work, MOS means multi-object spectrographs. Exoplanetary spectrograph, that's a single object spectrograph. The record so far for an actual planet around a star is 0.5 meters per second. So that's 1 part in 6 to the 8. And what I'm pushing for is basically better than that for a multi-object spectrograph, which I think we can achieve within something like 7 years. Codecs is a factor of 10 better, you can achieve in the lab these numbers up here quite easily. On a telescope, so different matter. Now, this has already been achieved for attosecond spectroscopy, and a Nobel Prize was awarded, which is why we have laser combs anyway. So don't even try. But the thing to think about in terms of audience participation is the notion of what you can do with that. The acceleration from the nearest star, Alpha Centauri or something, is about 10 to minus 11 CGS, that's centimeters per second squared. That's way too small, hence a collisionless system. But something like the acceleration from planets, the acceleration from nearby stars, and even the acceleration from the large-scale potential, I think that is measurable, especially when we go to a multi-object spectrograph delivering 10 centimeters per second. So that's the basis of my Blackboard presentation on Monday. We'll look at that in all the gory details. But the poster by Barnaby, who's one of the research fellows in the labs, is sort of giving you a sense of what that technology is doing, where it's going, and how it's achieving these sorts of numbers. Thank you.
Okay, a quick question for Joss.
It doesn't have to be one.
Well, you get one.
Well done.
So operationally, stellar, granularity on stellar surfaces are introducing those sort of radial velocity signals. So, like with the instrument you're building, how much time do you like? Will you be able to control that through like time series or something?
Yeah. So the actual approach. That's a very good question. For me, what interests me is root n. So basically, and the pull of planets is actually a real problem. Plajon and star spots are lesser of a problem. Planets are a real big problem. And I want to basically form a map of a million stars and basically use root n and some clever tricks to beat down these sorts of effects, assuming they're uncorrelated. I did recently learn that M67, someone was telling me, is a field with stars that do look correlated. So it may not be as easy as we thought.
Oh.
Oh, you can make it. You can make it fun
or trivial. Back of the envelope calculation to do Olympus Mons pointing at us or not. What's the differential acceleration there?
Yeah, actually, the sense of the solar system itself is a very key issue. Yeah, but these things are being corrected for already with things like LIGO. We have models of all these things, and even Gaia has an immensely complex model for the sorry. No, it's true. No, acceleration, the world of accelerations, these are calibratable things, though. We know where Olympus Mons is, for example.
Okay.
It's very rich. It's a rich world.
Let's move on to the final talk, which is Zhen Yuan from the Shanghai Observatory. Should I be seeing what Heidi's writing on the board?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. So Zhen Yuan from Shanghai Observatory.
Hi, I'm a postdoc in Shanghai Astronomical Observatory. First of all, I need to apologize. My poster is not here yet. So I decided to do it in the last minute. I promise I will have a small poster at noon. What I will do is rediscover a string, which is called Theta the Polar String. It was discovered by Heidi about 10 years ago. So in this work, I found a new counterpart of Theta Polar String, and also confirmed it's associated with a globular cluster. So the data I use is Lamos DL5, the K-Giants data, plus BHB from Seagrave, and I use a promotion from Gaia DL2. The distance is photometric, and the uncertainty is about 15%. So we develop a clustering method based on self-organizing map. And this method paper has published, you can find it in archive. So what some self-organizing map does is to learn all the data structure of ND space and then map it to a 2D space. And from that, so based on all the information of this map, I can identify groups. So these light shaded clouds corresponding to the clusters in a data set. So this large patch is identified, and if I plot all the stars associated with this, it is a Sagittarian stream. And I also map all the globular clusters to this trend map. And I see five globular clusters sitting in this patch, and these are the confirmed globular clusters with Sagittarius. And I did the same thing and found another patch, which is the Cetus polar stream. And I found NGC 5824 is associated with that. Actually, this association is postulated by Heidi in her discovery paper. And now we can confirm it comes from the same system. And we think it's a low mass dwarf because by the Madalese distribution of these three members, the Madalese peak is around -2. And it means the stellar mass can be 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 6 solar mass. So this part is the new thing. They have the similar angular momentum and energy with the existing Theta stream here. And we also find a new component in this stream had a little bit different velocity. So we trace some stream star from the discovery, and we can more or less feed the streams along the orbits. But it seems like all the streams is drift along three orbital periods, which is about 1.8 giga years. So it's a very diffuse and long stream. So I think the most important message is we have a stream, and from the orbital direction, we think now it's not really polar. The inclination angle is 45 degrees. And we think along with the globule cluster, they come from a low mass dwarf galaxy. And after yesterday's talk, I add one line is, this system also hit the disk. And the last passage is probably 300 million years ago. Okay. So,
okay. Ting.
Oh. Well, I maybe see the answer before I ask. So I would like to know what's the mass of this progenitor roughly. I think it says 10^4 to 10^6.
Yeah, this is stellar mass. So yeah mass. We are not sure about the dark matter halo mass. We are trying to reproduce the streaming by doing the unbody simulation, but it takes time.
Any more questions? No? Okay. Actually, no, let me ask a question. Why should I use your code rather than DBSCAN?
So first of all, for the diffuse thing in the phase space, it's better to use a distance-based method because when you look at the phase space, it's not really two component of some distribution. So actually, I compare my code with friends of friends, which is you can see the comparison in the method paper. I apply this method to find the members for open cluster and the other group use DBSCAN to find it. So we have similar but not same result, but they have lots of parameters to tune. And this method, because we use all the information of the data, so we have better idea about how to identify groups. Yeah.
Okay, that's our final poster talk. So let's thank all of our poster presentation people again. And before we rush off for lunch, we have some announcements.